Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 77 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm your host, Neil Tyra, back after the Labor Day break. And my guest today is Andrew Sindler. Andrew's an attorney here in the Maryland area, Montgomery County, whose primary focus is on personal injury, but more specifically on Social Security disability law. And you're going to hear he has a kind of an interesting story about how he came about to being a solo practitioner, coming from working in a medium-sized firm that he then left, took a bunch of cases with him in the hopes that he was going to use those to make himself attractive as a new hire to another firm. And in the meantime, he took on a role as in-house counsel for a nonprofit who then went out of business. But fortunately for him, his side gig, that solo practice, if you will, was going gangbusters and continuing to grow. And so now he's a solo practitioner and doing quite well. And so we're going to hear how that came to be and how he's scaled his practice to meet the needs of his clients. So let's listen to Andrew Sindler. Andrew Sindler, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me today.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, Andrew. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. Well, I didn't take the conventional route to get to be a solo practitioner. It started back at the tail end of 2010. I had just left the firm I had been working at for almost 4 years. I moved out of the area. And when I moved, I took about roughly 30 or 40 cases that I had with me. And initially, I was working them up just to keep them going, but my intention was actually to catch on somewhere else and bring those with me as a book of business. But that was a little bit more of a hindrance than I anticipated, and it wasn't easy to find a good mesh with another firm. So out of necessity, the law offices of Andrew and Sindler LLC was born, and it actually grew in an unconventional and unusual manner, because for about the first 3 years of its existence, from mid to late 2011 to around mid to the end of 2014, I was also working as in-house general counsel for a nonprofit healthcare organization. And the practice kept running as more of a side business, took on a life of its own, grew to a very respectable size, and has continued to grow and expand in terms of volume and the cases we handle by the day. And since they closed their doors in 2014, I've been strictly solo. Not something that I necessarily desired to do from the get-go, but I'm enjoying it more now than I did when it began, and overcoming a lot of the challenges that we face. But
well, it's a nice problem to have, because you started off with the solo practices being kind of a side gig while you were doing this work for the nonprofit. And then they went out of business, and fortunately for you, the solo practice was still going strong, maybe even stronger than you had anticipated, and you were lucky enough to just transition right into being a solo practitioner. So I guess it's fair to say that you weren't really planning on going solo in your legal career until it was somewhat foisted upon you.
That is absolutely an accurate statement. When I think about being a solo practitioner, I have three good friends and colleagues that come to mind. I went through law school with them. Each one of them had the mindset that they wanted to be solo practitioners. Right. And when I first got into the gig, I picked their brains a bunch about different aspects. They don't really do exactly the type of areas that I do. Some do some similar ones, but there were a lot of common denominators that I came across in talking to each one of them that helped me get my footing a little bit better. And then eventually I just sort of shifted gears, and it was sort of the, if you can't beat them, join them philosophy. And it's worked out well.
You know, sometimes a serendipity is, you know, the mother of invention or something along those lines, because I know in my own situation, the day I opened the doors to my solo practice, I had a former colleague call me and say, hey, the guy who was doing all my litigation work has gotten too big and can't handle these cases anymore. Do you want them? So literally, I had the phones turned on about an hour, and I got this lucky call.
There you go.
It would have been a much different and I think much more difficult transition for me had that not happened. And I suspect for you, you know, had you not had that book of cases that you brought with you from the previous firm that you were doing as a side gig, you know, you would have faced, you know, kind of the things that a lot of folks do face. They're like, where am I going to get new business from? And how am I going to get this practice off the ground? Not having that, what was your biggest challenge when you started?
Well, the challenge has traditionally always been, and this is maybe a little more particular to my practice, because my practice largely consists of contingency cases and all on the plaintiff side. And while they can have a very substantial payoff if you pick the right ones and you work them up properly, cash flow can, or at least let me state it a different way, predictable cash flow can be a little bit more of a challenge at times. And you have to really stretch the dollar. Sometimes you have to do a little more debt financing than you would like.
So just for our listeners who don't do that, you know, contingency cases, you know, you only get paid if the client recovers either from the insurer in some cases or, you know, as a result of litigation. And so you may have, if you have a big, you know, malpractice case, you know, you may only get one of those decisions a year, and that's got to sustain you for that year and, you know, forever down the road. Or else you may be doing a whole lot of little itty bitty ones like I did. I did a lot of car accident cases, you know, the $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 case that, you know, kept the lights on and allowed me to continue to prosper. But you don't know when that money's coming in. And so budgeting, as you say, gets to be a challenge. So how did you address it?
Well, it definitely takes, for lack of a better way to describe it, some creative accounting. You definitely have to stretch those dollars when they come in. For me, you know, I've done car accident cases. I still do them, different sizes and varieties.
Sure.
I would say my bread and butter type of case right now that sort of keeps more of the predictable cash flow because it's the largest volume I have is Social Security disability. They're not necessarily labor intensive cases, and they certainly don't drive up any significant costs. They're not traditional litigation in the normal sense of going to court and bringing in expert witnesses and those kinds of expenses. But there's also limitations in the amount of fees you can collect. But if you do enough of them and you do enough successfully, the cash flow will be steady enough that it will get you through the day-to-day stuff. And then as you referenced earlier, you get, you know, a garden or a non-garden variety large potential malpractice claim, or
I think we refer to those as a winner.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you get one of those in and they hit, you know, semi big to big, then, you know, you've got a lot more to work with. And then the challenge you face is more one of how much do I want to reinfuse into the practice to really expand and try to get more of those types to really keep things going. And then, you know, if you're even lucky enough to be faced with the potential of, do I want to keep this a true solo practice, or I want to bring in some outside people to assist me?
Now, I know if you're like me, the temptation is always greatest when, you know, you have money in your pocket.
Exactly.
And so you have to show some discipline. And I know of some, you know, personal injury attorneys who make it a practice of diverting some of that recovery, some of that money into a fund to sustain them for when those periods of time when there isn't any cash flow coming in.
Absolutely. And I've had moments in my practice like that where I've had some semi-large cases turn over for me. I mean, they're fewer and further between. And I think almost any personal injury attorney would tell you that, or any contingency attorney for that matter. And yeah, that's the exact philosophy I've implemented. I'll usually designate a certain sum, usually in the way of a percentage of the total recovery and or total fee, I should say. And I'll take that and I'll divert it aside to make sure it can't be touched, that it will be there in reserve when needed. And it served me well that way. I mean, I almost feel like I wear an accountant hat doing what I do half the time, not just an attorney hat. So that's a challenge. That's for
Sure. It's the necessity of doing something that you don't have a steady cash flow.
Right.
And you know, the same is true, frankly, of hourly cases. There are times when you have enough of them that you're billing that month for a good sized amount of work. And maybe the next month you haven't worked as many hourly cases. Maybe you've been doing those contingency ones and you have the same kind of issue. So I think that kind of creative accounting is really important for a new solo or somebody starting out.
Right. And it's funny you mention that, because in one of my colleagues whose brain I was able to pick a little bit, and his practice primarily consists of family law cases, which for your listeners out there, those are always taken on an hourly basis with a retainer. And you may have a tendency to think, well, the grass seems to be greener on the other side because, you know, it seems like it's more guaranteed. Well, the only guarantee he ever tells me is that he can bill the time that he puts into it, but at the end of the day, he's still got to get paid by the people. You know, he doesn't have an insurance company's pocket to reach into to know that the funds are there and that once it's ordered by way of a settlement or a verdict, it's going to be paid. Likewise, he doesn't have it. You know, he has limited control over being able to make sure that the clients are doing what they're supposed to do. And, you know, of course, he can default to, well, I can always terminate the client if I'm not getting paid, assuming the court would even allow him to do it, depending on how far along the case is. But at the end of the day, the one thing that I do tend to like a little bit better about contingency work is the ability to control those funds when they come in before they make their way to the client, and I don't have an opportunity for the client to try to pull a not paying stint on me. And you know, that's one thing that's always been a little bit more appealing about it in terms of doing that type of work primarily. Now,
I know very early in the game, in fact, the very first guest we had on the Law Entrepreneur was my former boss, Tom Simeone of Simeone Miller, down in D.C., and they do exclusively personal injury cases. And he made the observation that it was really critical, particularly when you're first starting out, to be as efficient as possible, because efficiency equals money. The easier you're able to get things done, the higher the you know, essentially the hourly rate is for you on a contingency basis. So how do you address that question of efficiency? Does technology play a role in your firm, or has it been just procedural development over the course of time?
Humongous role technology has played. No question about it. Well, my practice has over the years transitioned, and I don't even want to say gradually. At one point, it became a very abrupt transition, partly out of necessity and partly out of sheer desire, to an almost completely paperless practice. I mean, okay. It's not to say that you can't come into my office and find paper files sitting around, because I still maintain them just to have them there, especially when I need to travel and I can't as easily bring electronic, you know, means with me. But any paper that comes across my desk is eventually, if not immediately, going to be scanned in as a PDF and saved in an electronic stored file that I have access to from any computer with a secured internet connection. And I largely prefer it that way. I mean, it keeps me neater and more organized. I can find things a lot quicker. And most of the work I'm doing has electronic filing components to it anyway. My Social Security work for one thing, but a lot of I do a lot of federal court work, and federal court is all electronic filing. So everything has to be in that format eventually, to the point that it doesn't make sense for me to maintain much paper when I don't need to. And quite frankly, doing the type of work I do, it's a big cost saver too, in a lot of ways, including some you might not honestly be immediately thinking of. For example, when I request medical records for my cases, and I request a ton of them all the time, I can request an abundance of medical records that the old days would have cost me an arm and a leg, especially if it's voluminous records like a hospital, like a set of hospital records. And when I request them in electronic format only under the under HIPAA and under the HITECH Act, which is the one that was implemented for electronic medical records, and so many providers have gone electronic, the cost is cut down to a bare minimum. I think, just to give an example, it cost me $6.50 per request when I request electronically, and I have the ability to get it that way. And it saves me the extra added step of having to scan them in. So it's a win-win all around. A few clicks of a mouse and I'm in business. And if I should need to print them out, I have a printer. I have a working printer and scanner and copier and fax. I can do the traditional way when need be, but it is such a tremendous advantage all around. And it's one I wish I had stumbled across a lot sooner.
Well, I think at this point, any personal injury attorney worth their salt is largely doing medical records electronically in PDF format. And what do you use? Do you do anything special to mark up your PDF files, your medical records? Do you have a favorite app that you use for PDF markup?
So in my Adobe, I purchased some add-ons. I don't know if these would be considered apps necessarily, but it allows me to do two very important things, which have been a tremendous, like a godsend to me. One, it allows me to actually go in there and edit and fill out something. I can even put an electronic signature in there with my own hand or one that I've stored that was by my own hand. And I can type in where I would have to normally print something out and handwrite it in, which was tremendously time consuming. And I don't have the neatest handwriting personally, although I don't know any attorneys that do. And then I also am able to, and this came in handy tremendously for the federal court work I do, particularly the federal Social Security appeals. I can convert PDF files to Word files. It's not a perfect conversion, but when it converts over, like sometimes words might run into each other a little bit or things like that, or the formatting might be a little bit off. But what it allows me to do is when I need to cite to something and I need to take a direct quote out of it, whether it's a medical record or some other piece of documentation or evidence, I can copy and paste it once it's in Word format as opposed to the PDF and save myself so much time writing up these briefs that I have to write up for these cases. And yeah, that just has been unbelievably beneficial to my practice.
Well, I will tell you that I purchased Adobe Acrobat Pro initially for the very sole purpose that it would bait stamp documents.
Right. And I have the ability to do that too, which is nice.
To me, that was the game changer. Instead of taking the stamping machine and hand stamping each one of those pages of medical records, which is what we did not that very long ago.
Exactly.
Now I can do it, you know, almost instantaneously, and actually even have a little more information. You can put, you know, the case number on the bottom along with the name of the case, and then the bait stamp page marking. So that for me that was the game changer. How about in terms of document automation generating, you know, various documents? Do you do anything special to try and achieve some economy of scale there?
I wouldn't say I'm doing anything to reinvent the wheel. I mean, I've always used the traditional Microsoft Office platform for not just my solo practice, but even before I went into solo practice. When I first got into this gig, I was operating primarily off of Outlook with the task reminder system and everything that helps keep me organized and everything calendared, particularly deadlines and statutes of limitations on things and things of that nature. I have it set up now where it pops up on three different calendars and three different systems as reminders so that it's really bludgeoned into my brain when it needs to be. As far as document preparation and those types of programs, again, I've worked on the Microsoft Office platform. I also do a lot of work, and some people make fun of me because of this, but when I first started out, I found that it was a better platform for legal documents, and that's WordPerfect. So I use the WordPerfect suite, and I'm fully up to date. For a long time, I had actually been using a very out-of-date one, and the way you can purchase these types of programs and software now versus the old days where you had to go to a store and you had to buy the whole suite and install it, and instead of just downloading it and doing a monthly subscription or whatever you do, it tremendously changed the game for me to be able to stay on top of the latest updates and technology with all of those programs. And it really, really allows me to stay well organized and be able to open any kind of document that comes my way and work with it, edit it, do whatever I need to without having to do a conversion, without having to purchase something different. And that hadn't been my experience in a lot of places I worked. I was usually working on one platform or the other. I didn't typically have access to both. And it would frustrate me when I deal with opposing attorneys or other people that were working on the other platform and I couldn't do a clean conversion. So, you know, it was nice to be able to implement that in my own practice to say, it doesn't matter, bring it all to me. I can deal with it.
What about staffing? What is your staffing levels like these days?
So I don't, as far as my practice and my individual cases, I don't full-time employ anybody that works with me. I've worked with some independent contractors from time to time in the past. But what I do have that's also very unique to my practice, as part of my Social Security cases, I have a tremendous load of, or volume, I should say, of cases that are referred to me from a national company that operates throughout the country in almost all 50 states. And they refer me these cases to do when they're at a certain level of the Social Security claims process. And I work them up and they virtually become my own clients. They're not theoretically my clients, but they, for all intents and purposes, they are. And one of the services I get in working with this company, which is tremendous, is they have in-house staff that we work with in an electronic format. I mean, yes, I can pick up the phone and call them when I need to, but overall, we have an electronic, we do email, but we also have an electronic platform called ShareFile, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with now. And that has also been a major game changer in terms of storing and sharing of files of gargantuan size. I mean, I have entire Social Security exhibit claim files that are thousands of pages stored that I could pull up on my phone at the touch of a button. And even this morning I had a hearing with the judge and she was impressed that I could pull up the whole claim file on my phone. And I said, that's what this program allows me to do. But to come back to your question again, this company provides different staffing of different functions that you'd need in a traditional law firm environment. They have paralegals, they have legal assistants, They have medical records clerks, they have regular law clerks, and they have staff attorneys to deal with internal matters. And at any given moment, if I need to lean on any of them at any given time, I can do that very cleanly as if they are my own staff and somebody else's foot in the bill, which is really, really nice.
Well, that latter part is even the best yes. part of it. Now, how about for your own PI cases, personal injury cases? Do you use any virtual assistants there to provide paralegal support or legal secretary type support?
I have used it on occasion in the past. I don't typically rely on that. And that's mainly because I've managed to turn my practice into a very technologically efficient one on many, many levels. And, you know, a lot of times I will do a lot of the same work the same way over and over again because it is a big time saver. And when I can use technology to my advantage to do things that I might ordinarily delegate out to an assistant or a paralegal, as I've done in the past, I can do it just as quickly and efficiently on my own. It cuts down on costs, of course, but it also allows me to have a little bit more oversight and control, which I wouldn't say that I'm a micromanager by nature. I'm hardly that. I've managed people for almost my entire career, but I do like to be in the know more than the average person. And, you know, it's not always as convenient to have to wait on somebody to get back to you on a status update when you can just as easily know what's going on your own. So that, you know, part of that's by design.
The trade-off there, though, is you have to be efficient in doing that. Otherwise you're using yourself as a pretty highly compensated, admin. But along the way, so you made a lot of great decisions. You know, some fell in your lap, and that's great. What I'm certain that you probably had a couple of decisions or a couple of problems that you wished you would have handled differently. Does a lessons learned story come to mind that you'd care to share?
A lessons learned story.
Something that you wish you had done differently, or that didn't turn out as well as you had hoped.
This probably isn't the most earth-shattering story out there, but I would probably say that once in a while I've invested in something that didn't really pan out. I don't want to mislead when I use the word
we invested. All have.
Yes, exactly.
We all have invested in something that sometimes doesn't pan out. So what was yours?
When we come back to technology discussions, there was a platform, a database type of platform that I used for my Social Security practice. I couldn't tell you how many years ago it was. I want to say it's maybe like 3-4 years ago. And it was lauded at the time as really on the cutting edge. And it was really the best they had out there. And I tried it out. I committed to it for a year. I almost immediately regretted it. And I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't find legal loopholes to. And I didn't see the forest for the trees at the time. It didn't occur to me that I would be doubling my workload by doing with this program and entering things into this database for each of my clients the same exact way that I've done traditionally throughout the years of my practice, using my normal platforms with Outlook and the Microsoft Office suite and everything else I do, and, you know, PDFing documents. It literally doubled my workload of doing the exact same thing. I mean, it'd be one thing if it was just doubling my workload because I had more work to do, but this was me doing the same task more than once to try to utilize the benefits of realize the benefits of the software. And it provided no clear edge for me. And I realized it was an investment down the drain. I've had other occasions where the same thing has occurred. Not to get into a long story about it, but legal research platforms that I've used and subscriptions that I've undertaken that I wish I hadn't. And I committed to those for a year at a time, and I canceled those out when I realized it was kind of just money down the drain again.
Yeah. So I think the lesson to be learned from that is that we all chase after those kinds of things on occasion, thinking that they're going to make life a little easier for us. And you just have to evaluate it and do as much due diligence as you can. And if you find out that you're involved in something or with a platform or a product that's not meeting your needs, move on. Don't stick around and continue to throw good money after bad.
Exactly.
Now, did you use anybody to help develop your website? Your website is pretty robust. And is that something you did yourself, or did you outsource that?
I outsourced it. I mean, I did have input in the design that I chose and the content that's on there. I actually came upon that. It was really, really odd. And I wasn't looking to do this necessarily because to be very candid, very little traffic is driven to me as far as my practice through that website. I don't get most of my referrals of cases do not come through there. It's really there so I have an online presence. And so that when you Google me, an actual website comes up that goes to my law firm. It's amazing to me these days how many defense firms out there, particularly, I guess what you'd consider in-house counsel type, but they're actual law firms, but they're like in-house counsel for insurance companies that don't have actual websites. And when you type in the lawyer's name to try to like get their contact information, for example, you come across, you know, a find law page or something like that, and you don't have any official way to really track them down and look into their credentials. So I knew I didn't want to have that. But the way I sort of stumbled into this is another subscription I undertook that I wish I hadn't because it hasn't paid off in the slightest is one to try to boost my mediation practice a little bit because I've been a certified mediator as long as I've been an attorney and I get referrals from the courts on occasion, but I don't really have a private mediation practice of private referral sources. And when I undertook this subscription with this particular website, they strongly encouraged me to get a website for my practice to link to it. And then they put me in touch with a person that had a business. It was based down in Florida. I worked with the guy remotely and he set me up. And, you know, I'm proud of it for what it is. It's nothing that innovative, as I'm sure you've seen. But again, it gives me an online presence. It gets me out there. You know, people can reach me that way. I have a Facebook page for my practice nowadays. You have to have that kind of thing. Same thing with LinkedIn. And people can reach me all over the place doing that. And it's just what I want. I don't need to have people. And quite frankly, for the clientele I serve, most of them don't find me that way anyway, and I wouldn't expect them to. So it serves me.
As usual, it's one of those cases of don't fix what isn't broken.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more.
What's working for you seems to be working very well. Well, Andrew, I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Tell our audience a little how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up on anything.
Sure, no problem. So my law firm website address is www.andrewsindler, that's S as in Sam, I, N as in Nancy, D as in dog, L-E-R, law.com, www.andrewsindlerlaw.com. Law offices of Andrew N. Sindler, LLC, has its own Facebook page. You can follow me on there. I put up posts every so often just to sort of update what's going on or comment on the current state of affairs as it pertains to what I'm doing. LinkedIn, I have my page there. My email address is my first and last name, andrewsindler@gmail.com. And all my contact information is on my website as well, including that email address. So, you know, I'm out there and I'm always available to chat.
Great. Well, again, I appreciate you being on The Law Entrepreneur, and we look forward to staying in touch with you.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Once again, I'd like to thank our friends at Market Circle, the makers of Daylight and Spotlight Branding, for being sponsors of today's podcast. Market Circles, as the makers of Daylight, provide the tool that I use to manage my cases, my clients, my calendar, my to-dos, the emails, and they do so all in one app that stays with me on my Mac, my iPhone, and my iPad. I use Daylight on my own in a solo environment, but you can also use it in a team. You can use Daylight to track the status of cases and delegate tasks to one another on your team, and you can see everyone's schedule all without having to interrupt anyone. Daylight is one of the tools that I use to stay organized, and it increases my efficiency. And therefore, it only stands to reason that it'll do the same for you and your team if you use it in a broader environment. So visit marketcircle.com/daylight to try Daylight free for 30 days. And be sure to let them know that you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur in order to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. Also, our friends at Spotlight Branding, as always, have been very helpful in sponsoring this podcast. You know, I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to help keep me top of mind with my referral network. So visit www.spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur. So spotlightbranding.com/TLE to access your free gift. And as always, make sure that you visit our website, www.thelawentrepreneur.com, to see everything that's going on with the podcast and subscribe to our newsletter so that you can stay in the know and be the first on your block, so to speak, to gain insight into what's going on here. So once again, thanks for being here this time around. I appreciate your listenership. Hope to see you again next week on The Law Entrepreneur.